At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Japan's lost decade, and it was really nearly two, looms large right now as a cautionary tale for the world. Japan was golden, a superstar, a powerhouse. In 1990, it hit a wall. A real estate bubble burst, banks stumbled, its stock market crashed, and Japan has had a very rough time getting back up off the floor. Americans have had their own battle with slumping wages, then crash and unemployment. What if it goes on and on? This hour on Point, the risk of a Japan-style lost decade here, and what it could mean. You can join the conversation. Are we already there? How will we cope if employment, the economy, take years to come back? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We will hear in this hour from Richard Koo, chief economist for the research arm of Nomura Securities in Tokyo. And we will check in on the Occupy Wall Street protesters who have been marching, sitting in, and getting arrested in big numbers by the police in New York. But first, to the risk and reality, possibility, potential of a lost decade. It's not only in the United States people are talking about this. Here's a labor leader in England. It's a worldwide thing right now, talking at a conference in Liverpool just yesterday.
These are the darkest, most dangerous times, certainly in my lifetime. Britain, the world, is facing the threat of something that most of us have never read about other than in the history books, a decade of economic stagnation.
A decade of economic stagnation. Europe is staring at it. The United States is wondering about it. All kinds of people scratching their head wondering, what will it take to get things going? And could it be a long, long time before that happens? Joining me now from Philadelphia is Betsy Stevenson, chief economist until September at the U.S. Department of Labor, right out of there. She's now at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School and a visiting professor at Princeton. Betsy Stevenson, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, it's my pleasure to be here.
And with us from New York, we're joined by Richard Katz, editor-in-chief of the newsletter The Oriental Economist and author of The System That Soured, The Rise and Fall of the Japanese Economic Miracle. In 2009, he testified before Congress on lessons for the U.S. from Japan's banking crisis. Rick Katz, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for inviting me.
Betsy, we'll talk about what happened in Japan, but why are all the storm flags up right now? I mean, I'm looking here at recent news stories and just economist after economist, and not everyone agrees, and we hope it doesn't happen. But many right now are saying this could take years to get out of, and it could get worse before it gets better. Why all that concern right now, Betsy?
Well, I think we've seen a recovery that just hasn't been robust. I mean, we had an extraordinarily deep downturn. And in fact, we've learned from recent data that the downturn was even worse than we realized. The revisions to GDP have shown us that the downturn back in 2008 was even deeper than we had originally realized. And if you look at a per capita basis, our growth was problematic in 2007, and this downturn might have even started in late 2006. So we've been in a deep hole for a long time, and we're just not really digging our way out of it. It's not just jobs. I mean, on September 2nd, we saw zero job growth, and that's worrisome. But we're seeing zero job growth because we're seeing low GDP growth. So this is very different from the types of jobless recoveries people have talked about. The problem here is actually getting the recovery going.
We'll talk about whether or not we're stuck and what it may look like if indeed we are stuck, if indeed it does take years to get things going again. Rick Katz, you've looked closely at Japan's story. I mean, it still kind of boggles the mind. Their stock market, the Nikkei, still, almost 80% below the peak it hit in 1990. before the bust hit there. What happened to Japan, Rick?
Well, Japan's story is a very, very complicated story and very different from that of the U.S. Here's the analogy I would use. You take a guy who's eating French fries and bacon and all kinds of fat for year and year and year, and he's got hardening of the arteries, and one day he lifts something cold in the winter and he has a heart attack. His problem is not that he lifted something cold. His problem is the years and the years of the hardening of the arteries. In the U.S., you bought a bunch of people who are sort of crazy getting into a car, by which I mean the market fundamentalists who apply no rules to the financial markets, and they start driving in a wacky way, and they have a car crash. Now, they're both in the hospital, but the causes are very different, and the cures are very different, and the severity of the situation is very different. If I could just give you a few examples of what it would be like if the U.S. were to enter a Japan situation, which I do not think it will.
Great. But if it happens, many are warning. What would that mean?
Okay. Let's say you bought a house for $100,000 in 2006. Today, the house is worth $70,000. If we were going into a Japan situation 20 years from now, that house would be worth only $10,000. Oh. That's a whole different ballpark. If we were in a Japan situation, manufacturing output 20 years from now would be no more than it is today. The Dow Jones is about 11,000, 10,000 today. If we're going the Japan route, it would mean in 20 years, the Dow Jones would be about 2,500. It would mean that women and men delay marriages because they can't afford to. They're living with their parents because they can't afford to set up households. They're having, instead of the two kids they want, they're having three quarters of a kid because that's what they can afford. And so it's a very, yes, the U.S. economy is in lousy shape and made lousier by, I think, some really wrong-headed policies. But it's a very different ballpark than that of Japan.
We'll talk about what the differences are, and we're glad to hear there are differences. Nevertheless, there are all these warnings up of things taking years here. And just at the human level, how did Japan deal with this? I mean, you mentioned marrying later. I've seen notes here of increased suicide rates. I mean, how did Japan as a culture deal with, how has it dealt with such a long desert of, you know, just bumping along the bottom, Rick?
Well, the first thing is that Japan spent about 10 years or 12 years denying that there was a problem to be solved, that they kept saying, we're just going through a rough patch, it's going to cure itself, it's going to be okay. In 1997, when the economy was still weak and they needed more fiscal stimulus, they actually raised consumer taxes by 3% to 5%, and that's triggered a new recession. Their banking system was broken, and they spent years and years saying, well, the banks will grow out of it. So the first way that the political system dealt with it was by denying it. The second way is that because Japan has been dominated by one party for 60 years, it's very hard to say, let's throw the bums out and get a new set of people who can cure the problem. So people have this very fatalistic sometimes approach in Japan that they don't see how they can fight City Hall. And so they become apathetic, not because they don't care, but because they don't feel they have the ability to change things. And so a lot of things then become internalized, and you see it in the form of rising suicides, depression, alcoholism, as I said, later marriages, children living with their parents, older people living with their children, those sorts of things.
And then they got Fukushima. Betsy Stevenson, nobody's saying these are carbon copies. There are distinct differences. We'll look at that. But many people are now raising the possibility that it will be years before we get back on the beam on unemployment or unemployment. And it's a much bigger issue than that, as you see. David Brooks writing today in the New York Times, the prognosis for the next few years is bad with the chance of worse. And his headline is the lost decade, question mark. Do you think, Betsy, for all the differences with Japan, we're not saying these are the same. We hope they're very different. But how great is the risk that the hole we're in may take us years to get out of?
I think that risk is enormous. I think it's most likely going to take us years to get out of this hole. Even if we had the kind of robust job creation we had in the 1990s, and during the 1990s, we did have just terrific job growth, creating 350,000 jobs a month. Even with that kind of growth, it will take us years to get back to the unemployment rate that we started with. It's also worth thinking about just how bad our employment situation has been for this entire decade already. Mm. I mean, this is why it's important to be talking about a lost decade, but also understanding we've already lost a large chunk of a decade.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now you'll accuse me of partisanship, but under the Bush administration, from the first 7 years before we entered the recession, job creation was 66,000 jobs a month. That's not enough to keep up with the population growth, mm-hmm. with the growth, natural growth in the labor force. What that meant was before this recession even started, just looking at labor force participation rates, it was as if we had lost 4 million jobs. And then, of course, the catastrophe hit and we actually lost 4 million jobs in 2008. That puts us in a really terrible labor market situation. And even if everything was coming up roses tomorrow, it would take us years to dig out. The fear is that everything's not going to be coming up roses tomorrow. We have a lot of political risk right now. We have a lot of politicians on both sides of the aisle who, instead of having rational, fact-based, evidence-based conversations about what can actually get us out of this mess, they are reverting back to the beliefs they've held for decades without thinking about how those beliefs actually apply to this current situation.
You heard,
and that increase in partisanship is producing challenges. And Frank, that's a lot of what David Brooks said today.
Right. So what are we in for in terms of this experience? You heard the British politician there. They've got their own issues in Europe, but they touch us too, saying, you know, most of us have never experienced anything like this except in history books. Are Americans looking at that kind of immediate future, Betsy?
Well, I think that we've been going through rough times, and we've got some rough times still ahead of us. But I do think there are actually things we can do to get out of this mess.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking today about the risk of a Japan-style lost decade in the USA. Some would say we've spent most of one in that lost status already, but the fear is there may be more, much more to come. We've been talking this hour with Betsy Stevenson. She's just out of her job as chief economist at the U.S. Department of Labor. She's now at the Wharton School of Business, University of Pennsylvania. Richard Katz is with us, editor-in-chief of the newsletter The Oriental Economist Report and author of The Japan, the System That Soured. And with us right now from Tokyo, and we're very happy to have him, is Richard Koo, chief economist with the Nomura Research Institute. That's the research arm of Nomura Securities, very, very big player in Japan. He's advised successive prime ministers there on how to deal with Japan's economic and banking problems. Author of The Holy Grail of Macroeconomics, Lessons from Japan's Great Recession. Richard Koo in Tokyo, thank you very much for joining us today.
Quite welcome. Great honor.
Many people here are now worried that we may be in for a double dip. We may be in for a long, rough ride before the United States economy gets out of its current very difficult circumstances. What do you see here, Richard Koo? Are we at risk of a lost decade, the kind that Japan has been struggling with?
Well, I believe that the disease United States economy caught is exactly the same disease Japan caught 15, 20 years earlier. But if the United States understand the mistake that Japan made and avoid it, then I'm sure it won't have to take 15 or 20 years to come out of it. And the disease that Japan caught, I call it a balance sheet recession because there's no name for it in the economics literature, is that after bursting of the bubble, all these people who bought assets with borrowed money suddenly realize that they have nothing to show for their liabilities. So they are in their huge debt, but nothing to show for on the other side. Their balance sheet's underwater. These people have negative net worth.
Yep.
A negative net worth means these are bankrupt, but there are two types of bankruptcies when you think about it. Usual type is that the product you produce or whatever you sell will not appreciated by the society, and so you go bankrupt. But the other is that you still have a cash flow. Your cars and cameras are still selling very well, but your balance sheet is underwater.
Right.
And when you're in that situation, what is the right thing to do? They use the cash flow to pay down debt. And this is what you call deleveraging,
mm-hmm.
which is not quite prominent in the U.S. these days. But when everybody delevers at the same time, what happens to the macroeconomy.
Yeah, it goes nowhere.
It goes nowhere, exactly. Not only it doesn't go anywhere, it starts shrinking, because when someone is saving money or paying down debt, you have to have someone on the other side borrowing and spending money. But once in several decades, when the entire private sector decides to pay down debt, then even with zero interest rates, nothing happens, because these people with balance sheets underwater won't borrow money at any interest rate.
Richard Koo, let me ask you, in Japan, the bubble was in commercial real estate, the biggest bubble. In the United States, yes. Of course, the biggest bubble was in housing, residential housing. So that means
right.
On one side, it's big business money. On the other side, it's millions of American consumers underwater. Does that make it different?
Well, fundamentally, it doesn't, because in the U.S., it was the household sector that led the economy. They are the ones who provided the final demand. And in the Japanese case, it was the corporate investment demand that was pulling the Japanese economy, at least in the late 80s. So in both cases, the economy's lost the key locomotive. So in that sense, they are the same.
So what was Japan's big mistake in dealing with its problem? And how about the U.S. response so far from your perspective in Tokyo?
Yes. When you have this kind of situation where the entire private sector is deleveraging, paying down debt, even with zero interest rates, first of all, monetary policy doesn't work anymore because you cannot bring rates any lower. And the government has to borrow the money that private sector is no longer borrowing and put that back into the income stream. If I may give you a numerical example, suppose I'm a member of the household sector and have $1,000 of income. I spend $900 myself and decide to save $100.
Mm-hmm.
$900 is already someone else's income. That's not a problem. But the $100 that I decide to save, if no one borrows this money and spend it, only $900 is spent, so economy shrinks from $1,000 to $900. And $900 to $810, $810 to $730, if this process is allowed to continue.
But Japan,
if the government borrows the money and spend it, then you can keep the GDP from falling.
But with respect, Richard Koo, Japan spent like crazy. They built bridges and roads all over the place, even when no one was going to use them. They spent and spent, and have got a huge debt now to show for it.
Well, that's the way it's often portrayed in the Western press, I'm afraid.
Okay.
But when you realize that Japan experienced asset price decline, commercial real estate price decline of 87% nationwide.
Wow.
I mean, try to imagine Manhattan down prices down 87, Washington, D.C. down 87, yeah. San Francisco down 87.
Unimaginable.
And everybody deleveraging.
Yeah.
What kind of economy do you think you have left in the U.S.? You know, Japan's GDP never fell below the peak of the bubble for the entire period.
Because of government spending. So what was the mistake?
The mistake was that in 1997 and 2001, Japanese government tried to cut budget deficit when the private sector was still in the process of repairing its balance sheets. And economy collapsed, 5 quarters of negative growth. Budget deficit, instead of shrinking, it skyrocketed by 68%.
So you're still in the lost decade there, but you've got debt that's something like 200% of GDP versus the U.S. is what, 78%, something like that?
Well, if Japan did not make that mistake in 1997, I'm sure Japanese economy would have come up much sooner, because that massive increase in budget deficit, 68% increase in 1997 to 1999, took 10 years to bring it down.
Yeah, wow.
And I don't want the United States to make the same mistake.
So how do you assess what the U.S. has done so far? We're going to take this to Rick Katz and Betsy Stevenson, but how do you look at what the U.S. has done in this 2 years since our crash?
Well, President Obama's fiscal stimulus package, the $787 billion package in February of 2009, was the right thing to do. And I think that was key in stabilizing the world economy from a total collapse after the Lehman shock. And so the first move was the right move. But what happened afterwards, what's happening in Washington these days, as I understand it, is that now that our economy has more or less stabilized, people are saying, let's cut budget deficit. We cannot leave all this debt to the children. But that's the debate we had in Japan in 1997. And even though private sector is still deleveraging in the United States, if government managed to move toward fiscal consolidation, then you enter double dip. And that can be very hard to correct afterwards. I mean, Japan took 10 years to climb out of that mistake.
If that happens in the U.S., what do you think that would look like in this country? You know America pretty well. It sounds from the sound of your voice. What do you think it would look like in the United States if we go through that?
Well, instead of the economy recovering, it's going to get worse and worse and worse because government is no longer borrowing and spending the deleveraged funds from the private sector back into the income stream, and unemployment will get worse, everything will get much uglier, and budget deficit could actually increase because the economy will be collapsing first. That's what we learned in 1997 and 2001.
Richard Koo, please stand by there in Tokyo. Rick Katz, here's the chief economist with Nomura. You hear the way he sees what happened there and where the United States stands now. You said at the outset you're more optimistic. You're not as worried about this, but we're certainly not, we don't seem to be on the road at the moment toward the further large government stimulus that he's pushing. What do you see coming, Rick Katz?
Well, first of all, let me say that I agree with much of what Betsy had said earlier about the job situation. And I agree with much of Richard Koo, though we have other differences about what should have been done with Japan.
Yeah.
Insofar as what he said on the show here, I pretty much agree with what he said. So I do think we're in a lousy situation in the U.S., and it is much more avoidable. The tragedy is how much more avoidable it would have been in the U.S. Now, I think—
You mean just in these last 2 or 3 years, if we had done something differently?
Yes, if we had done the right things. For example, the Obama stimulus package, I agree it absolutely saved us along with Bernanke's actions as head of the Federal Reserve, saved us from the possibility of a new depression. But the Obama stimulus package was far too small, given the seriousness of the situation. He wanted something more like $1.2, $1.3 trillion. In the effort to get enough Republican votes for it to pass, it was down to $800 billion. They, along with private economists, underestimated how bad the situation is. In the last three quarters, all that stimulus has now been spent. In the last three quarters, government spending, total federal, state, and local government spending has actually declined in absolute terms. So in other words, instead of the federal government helping to stimulate growth, it's actually dragging the economy downward, and therefore we don't have job growth. Now, what happens to people's spending when you have high unemployment and it's less? There are two effects. One is people don't have the income to spend, but also when people are worried about their jobs being lost, they spend an even smaller share of what they do have, and they certainly don't want to buy big-ticket items like cars or houses or things of that type. So getting the unemployment rate down through fiscal stimulus would also cause the private economy to get itself in gear and create a self-sustaining recovery, and then it would be safe to withdraw the fiscal stimulus. It was way premature, just as Richard talks about the 1997 mistake. In Japan. And yet we have these people running around in the U.S. and Europe and Japan who sound more of a laissez-faire even than Herbert Hoover about the root of all evil is big budget deficits.
I mean, you say these people, but these are the leaders of one of the big parties in our two-party system. Betsy Stevenson, you spoke earlier about political risk here. You know how completely and hotly debated the advisability of more stimulus is in this country right now. And public opinion shows Americans, polls show even Americans pretty split and not too crazy about it after all the debate that they've heard. I mean, what is the risk here? The odds of more stimulus do not seem high to this humble observer, Betsy. What do you see coming?
Well, I think that it's important for the American public to realize that it is a really challenging time to deal with the deficit, and it has potentially pretty disastrous consequences. I understand people have sort of a reaction that they want to make sure they're not saddling their children with a lot of debt. But the truth is, there's one way to protect your children, and it's to have the strongest GDP growth we can possibly have. Japan learned this lesson the hard way. They tried to tackle their debt, and as a result, they provided a worse economy for their kids. And I fear we're thinking about doing the same thing in the U.S. I would rather us add a half a point or a point to GDP than to tackle the deficit right now. And that's something a message I think that the American public needs to hear, that this is dangerous. It's dangerous to cut government spending at a time when the economy is so weak. What we've seen in this recovery is for about every four jobs the private sector has added, government has cut a job. So that's like four steps forward, one step back. We've seen massive government job loss, and these jobs are important jobs for investment. We've seen hundreds of thousands of teachers lose their jobs in this recovery. That means there are fewer people teaching our children, and our children are going to be less prepared to enter the workforce when they grow up because they're having a weaker education. We see schools crumbling, and with such low interest rates and so many slack resources in the economy, it's never been a better time to try to provide better schools, better infrastructure, these types of things that will put us on a good path to having stronger GDP growth.
That's what the president says. You worked for him until very recently, but you know many, many people, certainly Republicans, are saying something different. Betsy Stevenson, Rick Katz, Richard Kuh, please stand by. And Richard Kuh, you in particular, I want to put in touch with our many American callers here, if I may. Simon in West Palm Beach, Florida. Simon, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I think what's being missed here is that, in my opinion, this isn't simply a recession, it's long-term structural decline. And what's actually happening is that the same thing is now happening to the middle and upper classes and American corporate profits as was happening previously to the working classes. In other words, just as we were unable to compete with cheap Chinese, Indian, and other labor forces, and therefore we no longer went after the low-end production, throwing our workers out of employment.
Right.
We now find that with their increasing technological capacities, and indeed our decreasing technological capacities, our ability to command a premium on what we produce, because either nobody else could produce it, or we were more productive, our workforce being more productive, is now being eroded. And you see this with the collapse, for example, Lenovo, Hong Kong-based computer company, has now taken over the personal computer.
So what do you see coming, Simon? We'll put it to our guest, but what do you see coming then?
Well, what I see coming is that, first of all, educationally, we're 17th in the industrialized world in the average SAT scores of our graduating high school seniors. So not only then we're losing industrial capital, but we're losing the educational capital that will give us the technological advantages by which we might be able to
come back. Simon, let me take that observation to Tokyo, if I may. Richard Kuh, what about this notion of long-term structural decline? You must have thought a lot about that in Japan over these last years. And you've had to face China as well. That's been a big issue for you. Do you see that in Japan? Do you see it in the U.S.?
Yes, we are very close to China, and therefore we get a lot of influence from what's happening across the Sea of Japan. But those are long-term issues. Though they cannot explain why economies all around the world collapsed at the second half of 2008. And
why not? Maybe it was just overdue, Simon might say in Florida, and here, you know, the bill came due.
Well, that kind of decline that we experienced, where industrial production in the United States fell to the level of 1990s in a matter of 3-4 months, Japanese industrial production fell to the level of 1983 in just 5 months after Lehman shock.
Wow.
You know, something like this is very, very unusual. And all through, in the United States, interest rates were able to control the U.S. economy. If the economy was bad, you bring rates down, and the U.S. economy would have responded. But this time around, you have zero interest rates for nearly 3 years.
Yep.
And the economy is still very weak, unemployment not picking up at all. Now, that's something very, very different. And this is the recession that happens once every several decades when private sector go crazy about some bubble. And once the bubble bursts, we enter this type of recession. And the last time United States saw the entire private sector deleveraging was actually the Great Depression 70, 80 years ago.
And here
so
we
this
are.
This is no ordinary recession at all.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the risk of a Japan-style lost decade in the United States. What it would look like, what it would mean, asking, is it avoidable. In a few minutes, we're going to check in on Wall Street, where there have been big protests going on for the last 10, 11 days. Occupy Wall Street, they're calling it. We'll look at that. With us this hour from Tokyo, Richard Koo, chief economist with the Nomura Research Institute there. They do research for Nomura Securities right at the heart of the Japanese economy. Richard Katz is with us. Rick Katz, editor-in-chief of the newsletter The Oriental Economist Report. He's testified before Congress on lessons from for the U.S. from Japan's banking crisis. And Betsy Stevenson is with us. She was chief economist for the U.S. Department of Labor until just earlier this month, now at the Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania. Dave in Boston, you're on the air, Dave.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
I wanted to, I think, maybe change the topic to whether we're making our way through to a lost score of years, because we've already had a lost decade.
Score, like a lost 20 years, okay.
Exactly, right. Because, you know, if you look at some significant measures, say, take, for example, the S&P 500 is now lower than it was 10 years ago. In inflation-adjusted terms, it's much lower. Non-farm payrolls, adjusted for population, that's, you know, probably the most important measure of the job situation in America, is at least the level it was seen in 1999. Discretionary retail spending.
Yeah, we get it. It's been a long, hard road. So what about now? Do you see more to come, or could we dodge that further bullet? Can we get on top of this somehow, Dave?
I don't think so. I don't think easily. We went the fiscal policy and monetary policy route. We've driven those two, I think, to their conclusion. And I don't think we've shown much for it. I don't think doubling down on stimulus is the way to go. And it might be that, you know, in our experience in America, we have to have pain in order to shake out a hard time. I think it's important to note that if you look at Japan, they rarely had unemployment over, say, 5% or 5.5% or something like that, which is, that's a very, I think, significant cultural difference between our, the way our macroeconomics work here, which is, you know, we do fire and hire.
Yeah. Dave, you put a lot on the table there, and let me begin to pick it up. And Betsy, if I may come first to you, you can hear this notion out there. It's kind of fatalistic. You know, this won't work, that won't work, stimulus won't work. We need to just to take the pain. What do you say to that, Betsy?
I just disagree with that. I think there are things we know we can do, and there are things that we should do. Obviously the president put forth a plan, and I think that as someone who worked on that plan, obviously I'm a little bit biased, but I know that that plan was actually based on research and what we think can work. And I think that there's more that the Fed can do. And if you go back to what Ben Bernanke said as an academic writing about Japan,
yep,
he thinks that there's more that he can do.
He agreed with Richard Koo that Japan screwed up early on. They should have done more right away.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And I think we're looking across Europe, we're looking at the U.S., and we're seeing that fiscal austerity measures during a downturn don't work very well. I think that that's a really important lesson for us to take. And I do, you know, in this show, we're drawing the analogy with Japan. I spend a lot of time thinking about the analogy with Europe and what do we need to do to get back to the sort of dynamic economy we've had in the past. And that's been a big pride of America, is that there's a lot of churn. People quit their jobs.
Yep.
People get hired. And what we've seen is just a really big decrease in people getting hired, but also a big decrease in people quitting. So there's not that kind of churn. There's not finding the best fit for you.
They're afraid to quit. They're afraid,
they're
obviously.
They're terrified to quit. But what that's going to mean is that it's not just the unemployed who are suffering, but the employed are not in the best job they could be in. And so we need to take action. This fatalistic do nothing and just let the chips fall where they may, I think it's a mistake and it will cause enormous amounts of pain.
Rick Katz, what about our earlier caller's assertion that we've got a long-term structural problem here? And maybe this is where we want to hear from you on differences between the U.S. and Japan. You say they're significant.
Well, first of all, let me pick up on something Betsy said, because I think it's really very, very important.
Mm-hmm.
The whole idea that economics should be passive, that recessions are like natural disasters like hurricanes and tornadoes and you just have to wait for them to pass, is just so wrong. on the basis of what we learned in economics in the past, say, 70 years. And on the fiscal stimulus, to get back to the earlier question, you know, it's like you've got a five-alarm fire in a skyscraper, and you bring one little fire truck to pour water on it, and then you stop, you put some water on, stop putting water, put some more water on, stop putting water, and you reach the conclusion putting water on fires doesn't put them out. Well, if you don't do enough, you're not going to have the result.
But our caller Simon says, pour all the water you want. There's a structural problem here. We don't have a premium, a value add on what we produce.
China imports from China amount to 2.5% of U.S. GDP. China did not cause our recession. Wall Street caused our recession. When you have what are called liar loans, which were later nicknamed liar loans, where you do not, traditionally banks, in order to make a loan for a mortgage, they had to follow three rules. One is you don't lend to somebody without a substantial down payment. Two, you don't lend to somebody unless they can prove their ability to pay. And three, you don't lend to somebody who can't breathe. Now, dead people got subprime mortgages. The Congress gave Alan Greenspan the power to enforce those rules on the so-called non-banks that didn't have to do it. Greenspan refused to follow those rules. These banks would generate mortgages, sell them to investment companies.
Rick, we know that story so painfully. Look forward if you'd be good enough, because you said we'd like to hear that.
Okay. Looking forward, I think the Dodd-Frank financial reform bill is, however, whatever flaws it may have because of Wall Street lobbying weakening it, it's the first attempt to say, let's get back to a sound financial system so we don't have a distorted financial system wrecking what is otherwise a fairly sound economy. I think this was a fairly sound economy, admittedly with lots of problems, including the labor problems that Betsy mentions, but it did not have to be this bad. So we need a combination of sound financial regulations that don't allow derivatives and such to wreck the economy. We would face years of pain and recovery. But if we apply the proper fiscal and monetary stimulus, we can cushion that recovery and make that recovery occur faster than the market can do by itself.
Richard Koo,
so we definitely
need an
activist policy on a number of these fronts.
Yeah, Richard Koo, one difference that we can point to is the Japanese were big savers in good times. The Americans were not big savers, and so they've come into this with a lot of consumer debt in an economy, as you say, which was consumer demand driven.
Right.
Japanese kept spending even when you were in your lost decade. Americans are having trouble doing that. So where do we go here, Richard?
Actually, there was a long period where American consumers did not save. And so we were all kind of brainwashed ourselves into thinking the United States is a low savings country. But when you look at the flow of funds data for the United States during the last 3-4 years, you'd be amazed to find that United States as a whole, the private sector of the United States, is saving massive amounts, truly massive amounts. And that's where this deleveraging comes from. Everybody's saving money. No one is borrowing and spending money. And that's why we have this recession. And that is also the reason why the government bond yield comes down to such a low levels, because there's so much savings, but the private sector as a group is no longer borrowing and spending money. And so all this money that people saved or used to pay down debt comes into the financial sector, but this money cannot go back to the private sector anymore, because private sector as a group is no longer borrowing money.
Richard Koo, you're watching all this for some of the biggest investors in Japan. They must ask you, what's going on over there? Do you think the U.S. on its current course is headed into a further lost decade?
Well, this means there's so much savings available for United States government to borrow and spend. And this very low interest rates, less than 2% for 10-year bond, means the market is telling the government that this is the time to borrow and spend money, please. Because if you do it now, if you have to do something, let's say you have to fix a bridge, If you do it now, the cost of the taxpayer, future taxpayers, are much lower than if we wait until everything is normalized, let's say 10 years from now, and do the same job. Then the interest rates might be 5, 6%.
Let's say so 10 years from that now, right, and right there goes a decade. There's the urgent word from Tokyo. And Richard Koo, we're very grateful to you for being with us. I hope we can talk again. Richard Koo with Nomura Research Institute in Tokyo, chief economist there. Thank you for being with us today. Richard Katz with the Oriental Economist Report, author of Japan, the System That Soured in New York. Thank you for being here. And Betsy Stevenson at the Wharton School of Business, University of Pennsylvania, just out of her position as chief economist at the U.S. Department of Labor. Thanks to you all. In a moment, day 11 of protests in New York against Wall Street. This is On Point. On September 17th, a loosely organized protest movement called Occupy Wall Street took to the streets of Lower Manhattan, waving signs, banging drums, and shouting that they were there to take back the country. The group is drawing comparisons to the early Tea Party movement. It's also drawn a lot of attention from the New York police. Get back, the police crying there. We're peaceful, says Occupy Wall Street. On Saturday, the NYPD arrested 80 protesters and pepper sprayed some of those in the crowd. Joining me now from New York is Bill Sapo. He's representing the Occupy Wall Street protests. Bill, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
What's it all about?
Well, I've said a couple times, most people, they want to find what it's all about. About the best way to find out is pick up a newspaper, turn on the news. What is the basic theme of this is if you have a nation, a society, in which your political parties can be purchased, it's not by definition a democracy. And these are people who have taken it upon themselves to discharge their constitutional responsibilities and to restore the democracy. Also, I would say there is a larger theme going on in that one industry of our society seems to be sucking all the vitality out of the rest of the society, and that cannot be permitted.
Are you like the Tea Party? Are you the same as the Tea Party? Do you have a different? I mean, Tea Party protests are some of these things too. What's alike? What's different?
I would say that the big difference is because of their structure, the Tea Party was easily co-opted. The Tea Party, I actually joined the Tea Party, I think within the first week or so when it was formed, but it was quickly co-opted and its message was handed to it. In this operation that we have done, I have maintained that in no way can I tell the General Assembly what to say or what to do. Unless I was representing myself as an individual member of the General Assembly. I can't tell them what to say when they get on their platform, but I can do everything I can to make sure they have a platform to speak from.
Tea Party's kind of come into the orbit of the right, judging from who's shown up for your rally, maybe more in the orbit of the left. Let's listen. Here's hundreds who have been camped in Lower Manhattan for the past 11 days. Come to New York as part of Occupy Wall Street.
Occupy Wall Street!
And here, speaking to Keith Olbermann on Current TV last week, Michael Moore said he had high hopes that Occupy Wall Street protests will grow.
This is really the very first down on Wall Street since the crash of 08 to take a real stand. And it's been powerful. And I gotta believe that even though it may only number in the hundreds right now, this is going to grow, not only on Wall Street, but in communities all over America.
Bill Sapo, what happened on Saturday? The New York police are paying a lot of attention to you guys. What happened on Saturday?
We had a march. Some of our occupiers marched to Union Square in solidarity with an operation over the Troy Davis execution. On the way back, there was some people overreacted, and violence broke out. It was unprovoked. I would like to point out that we have had around 100 arrests, and only one person was charged with resisting. Everybody else has gone peacefully, and even so, they've been beaten, maced, and not by all the officers. I would like to point that out. But as you know, violence tends to escalate, and once some of the NYPD lost their discipline, it escalated.
So what do you?
And also, I would like to point out that during that time, there were a number of journalists arrested, also, which that's a constitutional crime. Excuse me.
80 people arrested on Saturday alone, charges of blocking traffic, disorderly conduct. What are you occupying exactly, Bill? I mean, where do you have an encampment set up?
Yes, Zuccotti Park, now called Liberty Plaza, is the site of the occupation. Our people do not plan on going anywhere. We have people who have been through this before. They're not intimidated.
But you're not right outside the New York Stock Exchange there, in front of those famous pillars that we all know. Why aren't you there?
We're not there because Saturday, September 17th, which was the start of the occupation and was also Constitution Day, the anniversary of signing the Constitution, the occupiers went down to Wall Street and the NYPD extracted the media from the crowd. And after the media was out, the crowd was, the occupiers were driven from the streets. So on the anniversary of the Constitution, the signing of the Constitution, the freedom of the press and the right of the people to assemble was contradicted.
Bill, what do you hope comes out of all this?
What I hope comes out of this personally, and I think most everybody in the 99%, would agree, we need a more equitable society. We can no longer afford to have 99% of the planet working for 1%. We're not going to have thousands of years of effort in building a civilization. We're not allowing a small percentage of one generation to catch it up. This is not an IPO of our civilization. We're not allowing that.
Bill Sapo with Occupy Wall Street. Bill, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Bill Sapo spoke with us there from New York. Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.